AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at Rubrik.com. That's Rubrik.com.
And we are live. SB Talk Sports, Sean Will, Real Takes Over Fake Debates. It is Monday, Sean. How are you feeling today, brother?
Doing good, SB. How you doing? Happy Monday to you.
Yeah, happy Monday to you too, bro. You know, good, chilling, same old, do anything different day. Appreciate everybody guys watching. Make sure you guys like, make sure you guys share. And make sure you guys subscribe and join the Real Takes Over Fake Debate Movement live on every platform. Sean, I want to get right into it because there's a lot of things going on right now in the sports world. Obviously, we got the Naismith Hall of Fame was announced. And in particularly two players that I said last show was people was going to try to question why the Hall of Famers or even first ballot Hall of Famers, which shows how I got to say it nicely, how lost people are when it comes to that. Obviously, another all-time scoring record has been broken. Before I get into what else we go to our show, Sean, I want to say, as a sports fan and a fan of sports, I'm happy that I'm living through a time of a sports fan to see, like, multiple records, especially, like, all-time records where I have heard growing up as a sports fan, like, hey, this record ain't never going to be broken. This record ain't never going to be broken. Like, in both records and other records, talk about how these records have been talked about like this. For me to actually get to see it broke is, like, crazy to me as a fan. So I feel like it's what a time to be alive is to be a sports fan. Shador canceled a private workout. We got a lot of people signing money in baseball. We got to talk some women's college basketball, too. Let's salute to the chat anyway. Salute Tiff in the chat. What's going on, Tiff? But, Sean, let's get right into it. So the Naismith Basketball Hall of Fame was announced, class of 2025. Carmelo Anthony and Dwight Howard was one part of the class. But Sean, before I get into that, I want to stop right there because I put those two names in there first. Why do you think people are questioning why Dwight Howard and Carmelo Anthony is a first ballot Hall of Famer? Because I think is idiotic to say you question why they're first ballot Hall of Famers.
SB, I believe a lot of it has to do with, again, how we talk about, from a media perspective, what first ballot means. First ballot, third ballot, eighth ballot, 10th ballot, 500 ballot. If you get in the Hall of Fame, you're a Hall of Famer. We got to get out of this whole thing of, oh, they're not a first ballot Hall of Famer thing. Well, the question is not, are what ballot are they? The question is, are they a Hall of Famer?
Yes.
Did they have a Hall of Fame worthy career? If the answer is yes, then it doesn't matter what ballot they got in on. When someone doesn't get in on the first ballot, it doesn't invalidate their career. And I think we've got to get out of the place from an appreciation perspective of someone's career, because when you think about the Hall of Fame for an athlete is usually the final chapter to their career. Basketball, football, baseball, hockey, golf. That's usually the chapter that that's what literally closes the book on your career. So you wait, 4 years after your last year, and then you become eligible in Basketball Hall of Fame, the case of the Basketball Hall of Fame. I don't want to ever disrespect on any level what someone enjoying this moment for them, because it's a big moment, and not everybody gets that call. And so the fact that Dwight Howard and Carmelo Anthony got the call should not come as a shock to anyone. And anyone who questions whether or not they're Hall of Famers, I would question their acumen. Do you understand what being a Hall of Famer is or what it takes to get in the Hall of Fame. And no, I think anybody with any real sense knows that they are, in fact, Hall of Famers. So, again, I think we got to get out of this place just from an appreciation perspective, SB, of what ballot did you get in on? Nobody cares. Sometimes when you run for president, you may not win the first time you run for president. Sometimes you win the second time you run for president or the third time you run for president. It doesn't matter. You're still the president of the United States if you won. So I think that's where we got to stop that from an appreciation perspective.
For me too, I think I have to double down on what you're saying too. I have to agree. Like, I think it is coming from a media and unappreciative of what players is. And just because of, you might call the tail end of the person's career too, because I think that's where a lot of this come from, like a lot of these younger fans, because that's who be on like social media more, who only seen like L.A., the second run of L.A. Dwight, or people only seen the Blazers Melo, but like, you don't understand, like, I still have flashbacks from that game when the Knicks played the Bulls and Melo hit that three in the Garden and it splashed us and we lost it. I'm like, bro, but you don't understand, like, see how dominant a presence Dwight Howard is. Like, I seen a guy dominate a game and win defensively, because he controlled that side of the ball crazy. Like, Dwight Howard and Carmelo Anthony are two of the greatest players to ever play the game. Obviously, with those two type of players, I would look at them as specialists when it comes to a certain degree, but they also, at their peak of their powers, they were specialists in the things that they did, but they were also one of the best players in the league while doing it. Like Carmelo, scoring the ball. Anyway, you need a bucket, I'm going to get it. Dwight Howard, a defensive presence and strength. That's what he always brings. But I do want to get back to the class, talk to the class in four. The class goes as it follows. Sorry, the cough. Excuse me. 2008 U.S. Olympic men's basketball team. I believe that was the Redeem team.
Yes.
Carmelo Anthony, Danny Crawford, the referee. Billy Donovan gets in as a coach, mainly probably for his time in Florida. Dwight Howard. I was talking about Dwight Howard. Then we got Sue Bird, Sylvia Fowles, Maya Moore, and Mickey Arson. What's your all-around take on the whole class? And give me – I know we kind of talk – if you want to talk about Melo and Dwight again, you can. But give me, like, two other names that you want to, like, give acknowledgement to from this class.
Well, I want to acknowledge all of them because, again, this is a big moment for all of them. Billy Donovan, when you look at his combined time in college and the NBA, he has over 900 career victories. College and NBA. So that means he's been, you know, doing it at a pretty decent level for a very long time. I know some Bulls fans may not agree, but the fact is, you know, college pros, 900 plus victories. Obviously, when you talk about Danny Crawford for a long time was the standard of NBA officiating.
Yes, he was.
And so, you know, no surprise there that he got in. Sue Bird, we don't have to talk about Sue Bird. Sue Bird, you go UConn, USA women's basketball. Obviously, what she did in the WNBA, you know, one of the best, you know, point guards of all time, men's or women's, if you're being honest. Maya Moore is somebody who walked away at the peak of her career, you know, to get in the social justice fight and to fight, you know, some of these incarcerations that we see in the country. And obviously, you know, but, you know, Maya Moore was, for a lot of people, in that GOAT conversation, and for some is their WNBA GOAT, which, again, I'm not going to argue one way or the other, but when you look back at, go back to her high school, she was that girl. In high school. UConn, WNBA, USA basketball. I mean, she was just like that as well.
Did her leave? Did it put like that was like a like the Michael Jordan 93, like her leave, because everybody saw she was saying coming back. It felt like that, though. Yeah, like it did. It felt like that.
Yeah, it did. And you know, Sylvia Fowles, you know, again, when you talk about the standard of the two-way, you know, big in the WNBA, that's Sylvia Fowles. You know, she won an MVP, 8-time All-Star. You know, she was like that. And then, you know, from a personal note, obviously I'm a Heat fan, so Mickey Arison holds a special place for me, because I want to remind people the Heat started in 1988. It wasn't very good those first several years, but the game changer was Mickey Arison purchasing the Heat. And the first move he made was hiring Pat Riley to be the coach and president of the Heat. And that started the 30 years that we've had of Miami Heat basketball as we know it. Not to disrespect the previous years, because there were some good players, Glenn Rice and Steve Smith and Ronnie Cycli and Bimbo Coles and some names people may not know. But Mickey Arison purchasing the Heat, for me, that's the big reminder that ownership always matters. And so, you know, some really, really great years in Miami, South Florida, you know, became a Heat town in a lot of ways from a professional sports perspective. And it starts with Mickey Arison. And he's someone who's very, you know, kind of understated and doesn't always, you know, he's not looking for the spotlight or anything like that. But
he'd be out the way a lot.
But you know his impact, and you know the Arison family impact, you know, on South Florida and the Miami Heat. And so, you know, well-deserved honor for him.
I know you have it with Mickey Arison, because obviously he fan. But I want to tip my hat to him from a point of, like you said, like when the Heat really started. And what year did he buy the team?
Exactly. 1995.
He bought the team in 95. So technically, I'm older than the time he owned the Chicago 193, like 2 years. So for him, because it's a lot of teams that has been franchises way longer than him, and he has accomplished way more with his franchise than a lot of teams who've been here from the beginning. So I definitely want to tip my hat to him with the what outstanding job what he did with the Heat. And also, and I'm even looking at the list of players he done had play for the Heat. You got Ray Allen, Bosh, Tim Hardaway, Alonzo Mourning, Shaq, Gary Payton, Dwayne Wade, LeBron James, Jimmy Butler. Then you created a possibly Hall of Fame coach, Eric Spoelstra, too. Like, nah, that's something you got to tip your head to. But one person also I do want to know, too, is like Maya Moore. Like I was just saying before, that she left the game early. And this was when the Lynx was like literally on top of the league winning championships, too. And she still left at the peak of her powers. And I know she's been gone for a while, so it'll probably be hard to say it like now. But like right when she left, she still at least still had another 5-6 years left for her to still be at the top of her game. She was one of the best scorers in the league. Maya Moore was different. I'm not gonna lie. It was fun to watch Maya Moore play from time to time. I'm not gonna hold you at all. It was definitely fun to see Maya Moore play. And then the got to go to the Redeem team. Redeem team for me too, because what it meant for the guys to come back, because it was, we got to redeem and get our glory back. Oh, now the world think they're catching up to us. So now let's go ahead. Let's put a great team together. Let's get our glory back from Team USA with the Kobe stories, with the LeBron stories, and how like Kobe made the guys work out with the leadership and they bonded the team together. The documentary was outstanding too, so that did help it too. But I definitely had to go to Redeem team. That was one of them. I can say, like, you know, me growing and being younger, watching basketball and sports, I can say when it comes to Team USA wise, that was like the first U.S. run in 08 where I was locked in from day one to the end, because I wanted us to win so bad, because I was like, man, we're going to come back. We got Kobe, LeBron, Dwight. The team was crazy. And it was like, okay, especially coming off losing. So that was big. So I definitely like that one for me.
Yeah, I'll say this real quick about the Redeem team. I mean, obviously people talk about what happened in 04 and the disappointment of 04. I think historically, when we look back at the Olympic team since the NBA players have been allowed to play in the Olympics, I don't think there was more pressure than on any team than the 92 team. But I believe the 08 team, you know, certainly coming off of what happened in 04, I don't want to use the term pressure, but I think they understood that, you know, there was a great disappointment, you know, from what happened in 04. And even in the World Championships, you know, the couple of years before, that there needed to be an absolute commitment to, you know, playing in the summer, you know, and locking in. And, you know, you look at that team didn't have a bunch of guys who had a lot of Olympic experience. The only person that played in the Olympics on that team up until that point was Jason Kidd. And so, you know, the leadership on that team, but also guys buying in to, you know, a role and being willing to come in and, you know, basketball is not sitting around watching one guy go to work. You know, it's five guys on the floor being locked in, and the Redeem team, I think, embodied that, you know, incredibly well. So, you know, glad they're getting their just due.
Only Sean, I might have to push back. I know we got to move on. I might have to push back on you on that one. I do think 08 had the more pressure than 92, because I think when they first put 92 together in that moment, like, okay, yeah, we bring our NBA players back to show this point. But once they really got over there and everybody was just more starstruck and happy to play against them, I think when the pressure, they coast by everybody. When I look at the 08 team and then how 04 was losing and then how everybody was talking about we not scared of USA no more, the world, that's when the world was catching up. Conversations really, really, really started during that time. And it was teams like Spain legitimately thought they could really beat the Team USA team. And it wasn't no cakewalk in 08 either. They were like 92, they blew out everybody. 08, they won, but it wasn't no cakewalk. They had to legitimately win. And then because if 08 would have lost too, it'd have been back-to-back Olympic losses. That would have been bad for the USA.
So the reason why I say it was more pressure on 92 was because it was the first time they had done it. And there was, you know, that team could not lose. Like, they, nothing against the 08 team, because the 08 team did get challenged, you know, in a couple games. But that 92 team, they not just couldn't lose. They couldn't be in any close games. You know, so it was a different type of pressure. Now, again, there were more eyes on 08 because of what happened in 04, and certainly because of the coverage of the game, and we understand that. But, you know, the first time you do something, you know, it's like, hey, you know, we can't mess this up, y'all. Like, there's no, you know, redeeming us if we mess this up, you know, no pun intended. So I think I'm just saying from a historical perspective, I understand the Redeem team coming off of over that, that's how they get the nickname, the Redeem team, coming off of 04, you know, there was some level of pressure. But I'm just saying the whole thing, because again, I would compare the 92 team to like that all-time great band. They can't have a bad performance at all. They can't have they have to perform every single night, and they have to perform, not just perform, but perform to expectation, and the expectations on that team were great. The Redeem team, it was like, okay, you know, we know this is a new.
We gotta win,
but it wasn't this. We gotta dominate. The Dream team had to dominate. The Redeem team had to win.
Yeah, that's what you guys think. That's a good question. Who had more pressure, 92 Dream team or the 08 Redeem team? But Sean, we were talking about breaking records and records being broken. Alex Ovechkin breaks Wayne Gretzky's record for the most career goals. It was Wayne Gretzky was wet at 894. Alex Ovechkin is at 895. I definitely seen a highlight for that play, and Wayne Gretzky was there in attendance for the game. Shout out Wayne Gretzky too. They celebrated this achievement perfectly, I think. Wayne Gretzky coming on the ice to shake Alex Ovechkin's hand was outstanding. Crowd went crazy. The teammates went crazy. I think it was big. But how big is this? Him breaking Wayne Gretzky's record.
I mean, it's huge. I mean, when you talk about all-time records in sports, SB, you know, again, Wayne Gretzky is the great one. And again, there was a general thought that, I mean, if his records like this one would have a hard time falling, when you look at just, again, the attrition in a sport like hockey, you know, guys, you know, you have to play a very long time, but you have to play at a high level for a very long time.
Yes,
and really. If anybody had a chance to do that, it was going to be, you know, Alex Ovechkin. And again, I would say in a lot of it's not apples to apples, but Wayne Gretzky to Alex Ovechkin is Michael Jordan to LeBron James. And, you know, Gretzky was the blueprint that by which Ovechkin was going to be judged. Very similar to LeBron being judged, you know, against Michael Jordan, fair or not. And so when you talk about the best of all time, the best of the best of all time, Alex Ovechkin is right there with Wayne Gretzky and with Gordie Howe and a couple of, you know, Mario Lemieux and others. So, you know, it's a huge, huge thing. And again, you mentioned earlier, SB, to be around to see it and to see it happen is a really, really cool experience. And so, and Wayne Gretzky, again, was very gracious. He would never, you know, he was never like, oh, I don't want him to break it or anything like that. It was, no, it's when you get a chance to watch greatness, you appreciate it. And records will be broken, and that record obviously got broken.
Yeah, no, I'm going to say he even said that they played the clip back, and Gretzky been his way before he was even breaking records. He said records are meant to be broken, and he had to change his tune about it. And it, honestly, from my personal like opinion from the outside looking in, it seemed like Wayne Gretzky was just as happy as anybody else was when he broke it. He was excited and everything. So I think I think this is what you need to help the sports grow, because even like when it came to like the basketball stuff, people was even like questioning, or you know, you heard people in other sports, not basketball, I'm sorry, the NFL. When Saquon Barkley was finna break the the rushing touchdown record?
It was the rushing yards record.
Rushing yard record with Dickerson. Yeah. And you see how he was saying like how it was, and it was like it's coming off like negative that he wasn't like happy. I think sometimes we need to be the old heads and the youth or whoever's the retired guys and people playing now need to be more like this when it comes like this, because it helps blossom the sport, because now it's like everything is just about appreciative of the moment. Now I'm appreciating Alex Ovechkin at the moment of him breaking the record, but I'm also appreciating Wayne Gretzky for what he done during this time. Now I'm thinking like, damn, bro, he was that great. He hit 800 plus, almost 900 goals now. He done just did this. This is outstanding. Everything felt full circle good for me from a fan experience. That's all I'm saying. But Chuck, when it comes to greatness, they always come to comparison. I know I just said all blossom good moments, and then I just bring up this. I know I'm bookish. Let's play a quick game. You can whatever logic you want to use, whether you want to tell me what you're using for, but you got to pick one or the other and say why. So I'm leaving the ramp open for whatever, but you got to tell me why you picking it. Or you can't be like, this one, because whatever you're picking for, you got to tell me. All right, we're going to play Alex Ovechkin gold record or, all right, Alex Ovechkin gold record or Tom Brady's 649 passing touchdowns. What you picking and why?
Alex Ovechkin's gold record.
Okay.
Once the rule changes happened in the mid-2000s that essentially make it easier for quarterbacks, nothing against Tom Brady. Obviously, this is a great record. Don't know if it'll ever be broken, even though I do think there'll be some guys in this current age. Obviously, Patrick Mahomes comes to mind immediately. Who have a chance to break and pass the record. But just given the attrition of hockey and things of that nature, I would say Alex Ovechkin.
For me, I'm going to go Alex Ovechkin too. I just think, bro, 800 goals is crazy. From the point of perspective, like if you ever really watch hockey games, now it'll picked up a little bit, but majority of the time, what you only getting like what five to six goals a game, and then you gotta be like, you gotta be the one to score it too. So for this man to get almost, and I think I don't know if he retiring after this year, but if he play another year, he might get 900.
Oh, I mean, if he plays another year, he's going to get 900. I mean, he's healthy, so yeah.
Yeah, he's healthy, yes. He's 900, but I agree with you. I'm going to go Alex Ovechkin's goal record. Okay, wait. Alex Ovechkin's gold record or Jerry Rice 208 TDs. That's just, I did 8 TDs total.
Yeah, I'm going to say Jerry Rice only because I don't think this record will ever be broken.
No.
Yeah, I just think it's you got to think about it. I mean, just 208 touchdowns total, right? So you just think about if you're a wide receiver and you average 12 touchdowns a season, which is a good season for a receiver.
That's a good season.
If my math is mathing correctly, you would have to do that for 16 seasons.
I'm gonna say,
16 times 12, I think, is 208, if I'm not mistaken.
192, actually.
192, thank you. So, yeah, okay, my fault.
Blame you got to be over. You got to be over 12 touchdowns for 16.
You got to be over. So, yeah, so it's just, you know, I'm a believer. I don't think this record is going to ever be broken. And, again, you can have, you know, some seasons where you one or two seasons where you score 20 touchdowns and still never break this record. You know, so I'm going to say Jerry Rice just because I don't think this record will ever be broken.
Sean, I'll probably mush your head up even more. If you go 17 seasons with 12 touchdowns, you will still be short 4.
Yeah.
So that's crazy, by the way.
Yeah.
I'm not going to agree from the point that this record would never be broken. Because at this point, I want to see every record broken at this point in time. If I get to see every record in every sport broken, especially when it comes to tour, I'd be happy. Because you already got basketball, hockey. Look, just add football to the list. You kind of swayed my pick a little bit with the math you just did. Because I was going to go out of the basket too. Because I was like, because my math said was going to say like how the NFL is going right now. And they want more scoring. I can see it being broken. But for you to just – you kind of swayed my pick with the math because it's like you got to play good for at least – or like you said, a minimum of 12 a year for 17 years. Or if you get a couple, like you said, a couple 16s and the 20, you still got to play like a good elite for a good 15. You swayed my pick. I wish you didn't do the math because I was definitely picking Alex. I'm going to have to go Jerry Rice too. Tiffany said Jerry Rice, of course. Alex Ovechkin gold record, Sean, or Barry Bonds 762 home runs. And it's still that. So for all y'all people, for anybody coming, like, oh, Barry Bonds, I don't want to hear it because when I looked up on the record books, he's still right there. So all that extra, it don't matter. He counts. So I wish Barry Bonds had the torpedo bat too around this time too, man. That would have been crazy. It'd been about 850. But Sean, what we go? Alex Ovechkin gold record or Barry Bonds 762 home runs?
It's Barry for me. It's Barry for me. Why and Barry? Well, and I would say this. Obviously, we're in the analytics age now in baseball, especially guys are hitting more for power than average. And even with guys hitting more for power over average, you know, you would need 15 seasons of 50 home runs just to get within 12 of Barry Bonds.
What's the most home runs in a season again?
The most home runs of the season is Barry Bonds with 73.
73, yep.
Right. So you would need 15 seasons of at least 50 home runs just to get to 750 in your career.
Yeah, I was going to say, didn't Aaron just hit 50 like last season and we were celebrating it like crazy? Hold on. I want to look at last season. Where's home runs? Home runs. Yeah, he had 58 last season.
Right. And I think he had 62 the year before, if I'm not mistaken.
2 years before. Yep. 62. He had 37.
So again, you got to do that, but you got to do that for 13, 14 years.
Bro, you know how outstanding this is? I'm looking at Aaron Judge been in the league since 2016, and he only got 300 home runs.
Right.
Sheesh.
So, yeah. So it's just, it's such a, I mean, you, and also, you know, the thing with hitting home runs is they actually have to pitch to you. For Barry Bonds, there were games where they wouldn't even pitch to him. He would go weeks sometimes without them really pitching to him. They would walk him. They might give him one, but they would walk him. And then also what was amazing about Barry Bonds, and again, I don't want to make this a Barry Bonds conversation. Yeah. There were years where he hit more home runs than he struck out.
That's ridiculous.
So his hand-eye coordination, his ability to see pitches and understand what you guys were doing, and even, I mean, some of the best of the best, the Greg Maddoxes of the world and things like that, it's uncanny. I'm not saying guys today can't do that. I'm saying that it's the amount of consistency you have to have over a very long period of time, 15 seasons of at least 50 home runs just to get to 750.
Sure. How many, if they didn't intentionally walk Barry Bonds, how many home runs do you think he probably will have?
800.
I'm going to mess your head up. I just looked this up. This is outstanding. Barry Bonds, Barry. Sean, this is like ridiculous, bro. I can't believe this. Barry Bonds holds the MLB career walk record. He has been walked, Sean, over 688 times.
Right.
Do you not understand? That is.
Yes.
That is crazy.
Yeah, and I think there were years where he actually had more walks than strikeouts. That's how dangerous it was at points pitching to him. So yeah, it's. And again, we just saw Albert Pujols, you know, the year before, you know, he retired a couple years ago, get to 700. And that was an amazing feat because only four guys have gotten 700 in MLB history. So, I'm going to say Barry Bonds for this one.
This is from 2 years ago, Sean. So take it with a grain of salt. Not take it with a grain of salt, but obviously we ain't going to go too crazy about it. And like I said, I wouldn't make this a Barry Bonds thing either. But at a point in time, Barry Bonds had more walks than the Tampa Bay Rays whole organization.
Right. Which tells you how great Barry Bonds was and how much the Rays suck. So, you know, I just leave it at
that. That is ridiculous. So he really, honestly, Sean, I'm going to be real. He probably would have had about at least like 600 more attempts. You might be, forget eight. He might have to hit like nine. Probably.
I mean, obviously, a lot of
at least like 850, but you know.
Yeah, I mean, conditions and things of that nature. And, you know, I always believe the two guys that I thought could have hit over 800 home runs in their career were Barry Bonds and Ken Griffey Jr. Mm-hmm. Just the power and things of that nature. And, you know, but also you got to have health. And certainly, you know, you got to get something to hit. And so, you know, but yeah, Barry Bonds is a different animal.
Yeah, I'm going to have to go Barry Bonds too on this one, because when your record could be higher, but people are stopping you. And also, just to bring it up, I think from my memory of watching when I was young, I think Barry Bonds was the only player that I've seen that they walked him when the bases was loaded. Oh, that was like one of the first players I seen walk when the bases are loaded. And I remember it. And I was just like, yo, y'all, is it that serious? Is he that dangerous?
Yes.
Yes, it is. But last one, Alex Ovechkin's gold record or LeBron James' record for the most all-time points.
So this one for me is a tie. Okay. I can't go either or on this one because I think, again, when you talk about Alex Ovechkin, he is really the LeBron of hockey. Yeah. The longevity is a part of it, but the greatness combined with the longevity, you rarely see. LeBron, I think I've even said this to USB, LeBron, Duncan, and Kareem are like the three that kind of epitomize that. From an NBA perspective, that they were great for a very long time for the majority of their careers. Obviously, LeBron's still playing. So Alex Ovechkin, I think, kind of embodies that. So for me, this one is a tie. I can't pick between the two because I think both are there's inequality with this for me with LeBron and Alex Ovechkin's record.
I see why you said it's a tie, though. I'm gonna go Bron. From the point, because it is kind of, it's literally like the same record. It's like the same when we come to basketball and hockey. Because even if I say the reason why I'm thinking like I get to LeBron, because like he's still great. Alex Ovechkin is still great too at the same time. It's a toss up. This one might be equal, but maybe I'm picking LeBron because I like basketball more. I'm gonna go Bron. I'll be honest. Next up on the list, Sean, we got the Titans canceled private workout with Shedeur Sanders after Colorado's pro day. The Tennessee Titans and quarterback Shedeur Sanders agreed to cancel their private workout that had been scheduled for Wednesday, according to team reporter Jim Watts. Is this a good or a bad thing? Should we be concerned about this?
No concern. I mean, I think the Titans have two or three guys that they are locked in on that for that number one pick. And there's a good chance that they saw enough from Shedeur in Colorado's pro day that they don't need to do a private workout. But I think it's also just, again, you rather not waste the time of a player having to travel to your facility and things like that if you've already kind of, targeted, who you're taking. Again, I think there's probably two or three guys they're looking at. Certainly, we got to believe Cam Ward is who they're going to take. But no sense in them wasting his time. And for Shedeur, there's other teams, I'm sure, that want to meet with him and want to do a private workout with him. And the Titans, just where they're picking, it doesn't make sense for them to do that if they've locked in on other guys.
Yeah, because the only thing I was going to my question concern, like, is it we seen enough already from you, or like, all we got, I made a matter for a pick? So that's the only thing that was like my first question when I'm seeing this. But yeah, I just don't think the Titans are picking Shedeur anyway. I think, like you said, you brought up Cam Ward. I think that man made up so Cam Ward, Travis Hunter, or Abdul Carter. I think that's their mindset. But they also have been high on that they need a quarterback. And obviously, we know they need a quarterback. We know who's there now. So I just think they just been locked in on Cam Ward and just seem like that's the guy that's going to be on their team. I know Travis Hunter has been talking a lot, talking about he wants to go number one, and the commissioner better announce him as wide receiver and DB. But yeah, you got to take what it is. But I do think this comes from the point of, hey, they know who you want. Ain't no point of wasting this time. We got to go to some MLB, Sean. Vladimir Guerrero Jr. and the Toronto Blue Jays agreed to a 14-year, $500 million extension. Ooh-wee. The moment I see this, I wish I was listening to my dad and play baseball, man, because golly. Woo! What's your reaction to the extension?
Certainly was a little surprised. There were some questions about whether or not the Blue Jays would be able to get to a number that made sense. This is the third largest contract in MLB history. Yes. And, obviously after Soto and Shohei Ohtani's contracts, it's a massive, massive deal. But I mean, when you think about, his abilities offensively, he is a tremendous offensive player. Very, very similar to Miguel Cabrera, who's obviously a future Hall of Famer. So it makes a lot of sense for Toronto to lock him up as a building block. The question is obviously, you know, can they continue to, you know, add pieces either in free agency or trade to make themselves a true contender in the American League? But this is a starting point. And if, and again, you know, when you talk about we're in the age of offense, and he is one of the best offensive players in baseball, bar none.
Yeah, I think there's no question that you got to get this contract done. I'm not saying that, like, Toronto couldn't get anybody else, but when you got a player like that on your team and that type of talent, like, you lock them up. But I'm just shocked with the money shot. I was just like, bro, is it? Because I know when we see baseball players get these major contracts, is it really that big of a bag? Because you do think of the extension, how long the contract is. Maybe it's not as big as you think, because it'd be like, what? I just did the math. So it's like he can, like, what, close to like 35, 38 plus a year, 36 something a year. Yeah. So that was like, is it really? Because I know some players get paid that, like, but it ain't. Or is it the security that, you know, you still got money coming in for at least like that long period of time?
I think it's a little bit of both, SB, when you talk about baseball in particular and the fact that, you know, it takes several years before guys actually get a chance to really get paid.
Yeah.
Because, you know, teams can, you know, basically sign you or, you know, offer you these 1 year, you know, deals, particularly when you first coming out of the minor leagues, up to the majors. You know, you're playing on a 1 year, $825,000 deal, regardless of your production. You know, you hit 60 home runs, but if you're only in your second year at the majors, you're not making $36, $37 million a season. So for a guy to get to this point in his career where they are making this kind of money, it's a massive deal. And certainly, again, you know, for them and for, you know, he's their brand. And so, you know, so it's not even just about baseball. It's a branding and marketing thing for them as well. And to Toronto's credit, the Blue Jays' credit, they have been very aggressive in free agency the last couple of years, trying to get some of the bigger names to come. They were in on Shohei, you know, they did meet with Juan Soto, you know, so they've tried to, you know, spend some money. And I know we're going to talk about that in a second, but the best thing you can do from a baseball perspective is to lock in hometown and homegrown talent. And Vlad Jr. is definitely that.
Now, I'm glad you brought up about the money, because MLB owners feel a certain way. MLB owners reportedly agitating for a salary cap as players bracing for a lockout. Negotiations on a new collective bargaining agreement for MLB are shaping up to be just as contentious as you expected. Owners already are agitating for a cap. The Athletic Kings roster reported Monday players are already bracing for a lockout. Commissioner Rob Manfred all but promised when the current collective bargaining agreement expires after the 2026 season. It's also said it's not as though this would set back the next round of CBA discussions. Apart from what has transpired in the past, owners around MLB have unsuccessfully pursued a salary cap for years. The 1994 season ended in mid-August because of a strike, and the 2022 season was delayed by a lockout. Sean, what do you make of all of this? Because I can say MLB needs a salary cap. It needs something. It needs some type of structure. But yeah, I want to hear what you got to say, though.
So that's where I agree with you, SB. I think it needs more structure. It may not necessarily need a hard cap. Mm-hmm. I think what it needs certainly is to make it a little more difficult for these teams who are spending not to retain their own players, but in free agency,
Dodgers,
to go out and just, you know, throw all this money. And again, the issue is what the Dodgers did is actually within the rules. And it's within the confines of what is allowed. But I do think from an ownership perspective, you realize it's probably not overly great for competitive balance in baseball, which is what they want. And if you're a team, and I'm going to just throw a team like the Kansas City Royals out there, this isn't good for you for what the Dodgers are able to do. You know, and if you're another small market team, this is not great for you what the Dodgers are able to do. And so I do believe that that's going to be a big part of these next CBA. MLB CBA negotiations are the worst compared to the NBA and NFL and other sports. It gets very contentious. And so, you know, I think the expectation is if there is not some serious looks and contingencies given to how business is being done, there's going to be a lockout. And I think the players, again, are bracing for it, as the headline says, but there's some serious work that needs to be done. And I think Rob Manfred and the commissioner's office know that.
Yeah, even with me, and I know like everybody's getting my undertone that I'm like taking poking shots at the Dodgers. It sucks, but like Sean alluded to, that they did everything that's in the rules. I just want more structure when it comes to, like you said, when it comes to like the salary cap, and to make it at least fair enough for other teams to get players or add some rights where they can keep certain players. So guess what? The Dodgers, hey, look, Dodgers can overpay, or at least make it the ability. Like, I don't know if they got an MLB like NBA where you could pay your if you the bird rights, where you could play players more, you got the rights to the players to try to keep them, stuff like that. Because I don't think it needs about the NBA got like a second apron, a hard cap. It don't need nothing like that, because I think that's hurting the NBA right now. Like, it needs to be a competitive balance, but like, I don't think it needs to go as far as how the NBA is trying to go today, where they're like they're trying to make every team even. No, I think you should reward the teams who do a good job GMing, and they're going to pay players, play players, but also you should reward teams that have homegrown talent and they want to be able to keep their talent. That's all I really would want to see. I don't want to see the Monstars on one team because this one team want to overpay everybody. No, I don't want to see that. I don't want to see homegrown talent, like we just talked about, another homegrown possibly leaving this team. So I just think like, I just think they should just add more rights for teams when they have a player where they can get them more money or give them some extra to make him want to be more motivated to stay with the team that he was already on. And then also, I don't want to see a hard cap or a salary cap, because I don't think the Dodgers should be punished for what they're doing. They're doing their job. If I'm a Dodgers fan, I'd be happy. So that's the only thing for me. Sean, we got another interesting story coming up, because I want to open up this Pandora's box on this, because we have a player who's projected to go number two in her respective draft, but she is deciding to stay in college by entering the transfer portal. Notre Dame star Olivia Miles makes a bold move to forget about the WNBA draft, and she's projected to go number two to go back in another year of college. What is your reaction to this?
Not surprised. She can make more money with NIL in college. And, you know, most of these, when you know that's the situation, you know, there's no rush for you to go to the WNBA, because it's not like you're in a rush to go make all of this money in the WNBA, because you're not making all of this money in the WNBA. So from her perspective, with NIL and things of that nature, it only makes sense to do that. Now, the one thing I do like, you know, that she's doing is she's opened herself up to, you know, to potentially transferring. I don't know if it's guaranteed that she's going to transfer, but opening herself up to transfer, and again, pay for services. So which school is going to offer the biggest bag for Olivia Miles? That remains to be seen. I'm sure, you know, there all the big dogs will be looking at her, but to me, this goes back to, you know, it's a great financial decision for her over everything. I don't know what the 2026 WNBA draft will look like, who will be in it. But I would presume, obviously, if she's the second prospect or second number two prospect in 2025, she's going to be right there in 2026, if not the first. So, you know, there may be some of that in it as well.
Oh, wait a minute, Sean. I just thought about something from this point, because we just talking about the CBA and the lockout. Ain't the WNBA possibly going to a lockout too?
Possibly.
Lockout. And ain't this in 2026 season, right?
Yeah. Yes, after this season. Mm-hmm. Yes,
they could potentially
lock out, but they're at the table. They got to be at the table, obviously, trying to avoid that.
I figured it out. See, look, me and Show, because I just only, if we didn't do that segment, she waited a year. One, obviously, more money. Two, if why wouldn't she wait till the next year after the lockout? Because whatever new contract they might negotiate is possibly more money that could be in the NBA. And then her being the first person from the draft class, wouldn't she get more money too because of the new rule they might make?
Well, it depends. So a lot of times when they do these CBAs, these new collective bargaining agreements, if there's more BRI, basketball-related income, going to the players, all of the players will get more money based on sort of a percentage or whatever, what that is comparative to what they're getting now. Those things tend to work out. So I don't think it's necessarily that. Mm. I just think, again, this season, this particular year, it makes sense for her either to go back to school or to enter the transfer portal. You know, so again, because again, she can make a lot of money. She's gonna make more money this year than she would if she goes to WNBA this year. So that said, again,
yeah, this, I'm gonna go where I make more money at.
Yeah.
And then also, only thing, so I think once again, I didn't, because I was thinking I'm Sherlock Holmes figuring out the craziest mystery, but I think this is an outstanding move by her though, because like I said, it makes more sense. You make more money, you're gonna get more attention playing college basketball. Right now, the WNBA is up on the rise, but it still has not surprised women's college basketball. But also, bringing up the CBA, this brings me to a concern about the women's, because if one of your star players don't want to come to the league because she make more money and going to be more viewership, you don't think the owners and them going to bring that to the table and agreement to be like, hey, look, we do want to, but we're not really ready yet. You see, one of your top prospects didn't want to come to the draft because we ain't got it yet, or we don't have the attention that we seek yet. And I think that'll be petty business practices. But you know, when the collective bargaining agreement, whatever side you're on, they always gonna try to get the most from the other side. Cause I think that's a petty way to go about it, but I wouldn't be surprised if they throw something like that on the table, Sean.
I mean, I'm not gonna say that's gonna absolutely be a part of the conversation. I think the conversation is gonna be more around the WNBA has operated in the red for quite some time. This new media rights deal that the NBA just did, obviously the NBA subsidizes the WNBA. How much of that money that the WNBA is getting is going to be split between players and the owners? And is it going to ultimately help the WNBA in the long run not operate in the red every single season the way it has? I think that's going to be a big part of it. Now, from the players' perspective, that's probably not their concern. Their concern is, hey, we should be making more money. I think Caitlin Clark made $75,000 last year in the WNBA. And I'm talking just from her WNBA salary. I'm not talking about the endorsements and all that stuff. That's a problem, you know. So, you know, that has to be addressed. But again, so there's a lot of things I think that have to be talked about, but from the player perspective, it's no, we deserve to make more money. We're bringing more eyes and more attention to the league, and they should be paid accordingly.
Yeah. Imagine people, they're going to be any WNBA players are really going to move around when that money comes. Whoever paid them the most money, that's what people are going to go to, whatever the highest contract. But also, Sean, since you're a women's sport, UConn women's win a national title in a blowout victory over South Carolina. Paige Becker captures her first national title. And we got to talk about the coach in a second. Coach G, he captured his 12th, but we're going to talk about him in a second. But what you think about Notre Dame women's winning a championship? Is the what are we talking about them at as a school as a when it comes to women basketball? They might be up there, one of the greatest, if not the greatest.
I mean, when you talk about women's college basketball, it's UConn and Tennessee. They're the big dogs. I mean, just when you talk about like historically. Now, obviously, South Carolina with Dawn Staley's there now. You see Notre Dame, LSU. You know, UCLA, USC, like, so there's some big time programs in women's college basketball, but UConn obviously and Geno Auriemma obviously are the standard. You know, 12 national titles is no joke. And you know, when you think about the program he took over, he built that program.
Yes,
you know? And so you know, it's a. I mean, you know, and also, you know, I don't know what his future holds. I know he's talked about retiring and stepping down, you know, sooner than later. But if he does step down, you know, after this, or if he coaches another couple of years or whatever he does, his legacy is cemented. He is one of the best coaches. I'm not talking men's, women's, college, pro. He is one of the best coaches to ever do it. That Geno, he is like that, you know. So,
I think this was big for UConn, for them as a program, because I was definitely trying to go back to like the school history of like players around Geno Auriemma time where he coached G, what players he had, because he didn't had the list. I want to see the list of players.
I mean, it's too long. We'll be here all night naming all those players.
Bro, Maya Moore, Brianna Stewart, Nafisa Collar, Tina Charles, Diana Taurasi, Paige Beckers, Aaliyah Edwards, Swin Cash. Jesus, bro, the talent that he done had. I don't know if I said Maya Moore, but Maya Moore too. But, man, the talent that he had. And his coach, Geno Auriemma, the greatest because when it comes to this, because he got the most wins, done had probably, I don't know who had more talent than him. Then, like, if we look at this list, I could go back and imagine. I'm going up top right now. I can definitely about research more on it to see, but this is like,
I mean, it's him and Pat Summitt, you know, I mean, they were the two, and they had a really interesting relationship, just to say the least, but. You know, they're the standard, and they are the standard. And, you know, and again, rest in peace to Coach Summitt. But, you know, Geno Auriemma is, like I said, he is not one of just the best women's coaches ever. He's one of the best coaches ever. Yeah. And you know, obviously, you know, he recruits great talent, but, you know, he is not the easiest person to play for. When you go to UConn, understanding there's a standard, and you better be ready to come in and live up to that standard, and that's what he's about. They practice hard. If you ever watch like film of their practices, they go hard.
And then I was gonna say about Coach G, for him to be at the school with the prestige like UConn. And he the big dog on campus when it comes to sports, and it's the women's sports over there too. Oh, that says a lot. That says, because I'm trying to think what other UConn, what other sport? I think the women's basketball team is the biggest team for them, right?
Well, I mean, the men's team obviously in the last few years. Well, I won't say the last few years. I think UConn, I don't think I'm being disingenuous saying this. They might be, from a basketball perspective, men's and women's, the preeminent program of the last 30 years.
Yeah. Women's carrying a lot of that stuff, though.
Yeah, maybe. I don't want to say that. Probably the last 35 years. When you think about Jim Calhoun, and obviously, you know, fast forward to Kevin Ollie and Dan Hurley now, you know, same with Geno. Geno's been obviously the you know, there the entire time. But they might be, in terms of just college basketball programs overall, there might not be a better school for college basketball, men's and women's, than UConn.
I might not be. Let me and Sean know what y'all think about what Coach G rank at all time. We did was doing our draft comps again. So comment down below if you want any other draft comps. Or if not, then Sean, we gonna go ahead and shut it down.
Yeah, I got one for you. I got one for you, SB. The wide receiver from Arizona, T. McMillan. You got a draft comp for him?
T. McMillan. That's the one you said, the guy from Arizona. That's the 6'4" guy, right? I'm trying to.
Yes.
I think we did him. I see a little T. Higgins and I see a little Amari Cooper in him.
No, you didn't. We didn't do him.
Well, yeah. Oh, well, then, yeah, that's what I see. Little T. Higgins and a little Amari Cooper in him for me. What about you?
For me, it's Mike Evans and Drake London.
I like that.
Yeah, Mike Evans and Drake London. Yeah.
Thank you. I got to look at the NFL track. But also episode 56 too, Sean. Who you got?
Episode 56. I'll tell you in 1 second. I got one more for you. We didn't talk about him. Abdul Carter.
Oh, come on, Michael Parsons. That's easy. Penn State. That man looked like Michael Parsons reincarnated.
That's low hanging fruit. I'll go a different direction. Okay. I'm gonna say Abdul Carter is Derek Thomas.
Derek Thomas. Okay.
Yeah, Derek Thomas.
What do you think about that? Who your comp is for the kid from Michigan, a tight end?
Colston Loveland.
Loveland, yeah.
For me, it's Jimmy Graham.
Ooh.
Yeah, for me, it's Jimmy Graham. When I watch him, he is athletic. He gets up and down. He's the second tight end in his draft, Tyler Warren being the first. But yeah, Colston Loveland, when I watch his tape, he reminds me a lot of Jimmy Graham.
I could see Jimmy Graham in that. I don't even think about no Jimmy Graham. I could see that big body. You could see some Jimmy Graham in him. I won't say his name. I can also see him because you gonna bring up that name, but
or your favorite, yeah.
Yeah, look, man. Hey, look, Chargers. I ain't saying we need a tight end, but you know, I'm like, man, gonna bring your boy over. But 56. Who you got?
56. I mean, obviously, Lawrence Taylor is the first that comes to mind. I'm gonna say Lawrence Taylor, and you know, I'm gonna say Andre Tippett from the Patriots. Andre Tippett, yeah, Hall of Famer. Andre Tippett from the Patriots.
Okay, NFL gonna be the one for this one for me. Okay, yeah, not NBA, NFL. Yeah, I was trying to find somebody over besides Lawrence Taylor, but can't beat Lawrence Taylor. Yeah, I'm about to go Lawrence Taylor too. Also, Sean, you know we love running backs, so I have one more to ask.
I'm sorry. I can't forget DeMario Davis. My fault. DeMario Davis. Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah.
Between – it's not even necessarily you got a comp for them, too. But if you have a comp for them, I would love to hear it. Between Amari Hampton, Quayshawn Jenkins, and Ollie Gordon, which running back you think is the best?
Oh, easily. It's Omarion.
Omarion. Who your comp is to Omarion, if you had to pick one?
So I haven't watched a lot of film of him, but because I think he's really good. I think he's no doubt gonna be picked in the first round.
Mm-hmm. He might, yeah.
I think he is. I think it's gonna be. I think though he and Ashton Jeanty are guaranteed to go in the first round. I think it's gonna be similar to Bijan Robinson and Jahmyr Gibbs a couple years ago, both going in the first round. You know, Amari Hampton. I mean, I'm gonna say a little Joe Mixon, but I think he's a little bit bigger. Crazy as that might seem, he's the real deal. Like. So I'm gonna say just as a little Joe Mixon, but I got to keep watching some more film on him. But
for the list stuff I see for him too, and it's crazy because I was even looking it up to see what they said. I didn't want to sound crazy saying it, but I see a little Saquon in him and a little David Montgomery because I can see the David Montgomery one there, but I definitely see a little Saquon in him too. I'm not gonna lie, he's strong, he fast, he go to the right team, he gonna be a problem.
Yeah, no, I'm telling you, I think, you know, and again, I don't know if he'll last this long, but I think he's built for Pittsburgh.
Pittsburgh, that would be, I could see him in Pittsburgh. That'd be nice.
Yeah.
That'd be nice. Ooh, him in Pittsburgh would be nice. Yeah, I can see him in Pittsburgh. That's the crazy part about it. I can see him in Pittsburgh. We can see it. It's crazy. Ollie, I don't know what happened with Ollie Gordon. He fell off so bad. He was like one of the came into the season. He was one of the most prestige running back. Yo, but yeah.
No, it's not. I mean, he's going to be drafted. He's not a guy. He's not a twitch guy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's kind of more of a straight line runner. You know, mm-hmm. And so I think that's why. But he's going to go probably in the third or fourth round. I would be surprised if he didn't get, you know, if he didn't get picked in the third or fourth round. Yeah.
Yeah, but thanks you guys for watching. It's been another great episode of Real Takes Over Faith Debates with SB and Sean Webb. And we will see you guys on the next one. Peace out.
Real Takes Over Faith Debates.